Give me an F. Give me an A. Give me an I. Give me a... Oh, God, sort this. We'll be here all bloody week. You know what you're listening to.
Generic opening to podcast. Welcome, all that business. John, I hear you've won a short story competition. You said you had information about a short story competition. I'm assuming you've won.
Can we just...
What?
I mentioned a short story competition, and you're now thinking, why would he have mentioned that unless he's
won.
Got through to the next round? It's a round thing.
Oh, right, okay. You won the round.
Guess who's through to the next round of a short story competition?
You.
No.
Oh, John.
A lot of people, but none of them were me.
None of them are you? Are you sure none of them? Have you checked?
I have double checked.
Yeah. What happened?
It felt right in a way because we started the week with a very exciting recommendation in The Observer.
Yeah.
And that felt like a lovely little boost.
I like to call it The Guardian because it's got The Guardian in the website.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
I think it sounds a bit swishy.
It does sound swishy.
No offence to The Observer.
I mean, I think they're of equal import, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
But that was a lovely little moment of success.
Fantastic, yeah.
And we needed that.
Yeah.
And then following on the back of that, it's nice to sort of come back to earth, isn't it? I mean, straight back to business as usual.
Yeah. So what happened?
It wasn't very good, Tom. It wasn't good enough. But I've got some feedback, but I'm not going to share it now because I think we need to crack on with this excellent interview.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll reveal it another time.
Are you willing to share the story with us at that point?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Even though it's obviously now it's been...
It's inferior.
It is rubbish. I mean, that's...
And I have got the feedback as well. Right. I'll share that with you as well.
Can I quickly ask now, do you agree with the feedback?
Some of it, yeah.
Right, okay.
It's interesting because I don't know if you remember, but last week I mentioned the fact that it probably wasn't the right genre.
Right. Was that picked up in the feedback?
Weirdly, it didn't come up in the feedback. It
right.
as like a criticism.
Oh my God! So even though you completely got the wrong genre, that wasn't the worst thing about
no,
your story.
No, that wasn't the worst
wow.
thing.
Oh, I can't wait.
But
for
what
this.
Was weird is they didn't bring that up as a criticism, but they did say this was an excellent thriller. And it wasn't supposed to be a thriller. It was supposed to be a horror. So I feel like the person who was giving me that feedback forgot that it was supposed to be a horror.
Oh, we look forward. I speak for everyone here, John. We look forward to hearing that in the future and hearing the feedback as well. That'd be brilliant.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
In a way, I feel like it would have been disappointing for our listeners if everything had come up roses.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And if in series three everything started to happen for us. It would just ruin the whole thing.
Yeah, it'd be the end, wouldn't it? Yeah,
yeah, God. Exactly. So, we're back.
Normal service has been resumed. Speaking of successful writers, which we weren't, but indirectly we were, and we've got a lovely interview with Stuart Turton, haven't we?
We have indeed.
Proper nice chap.
Yeah. And we really tried to confuse him with our bizarre little... what would you call it? Like a little challenge that we set
up? Yeah, a little murder mystery, didn't we? Yeah.
But he managed to come up trumps, I think.
He did, even though a great deal of it made no sense. But for some reason, we've left it all in and not edited it out. I don't know why. Don't know why that's happened. Yeah, so we did the murder mystery, didn't we? Because Dave's on the interview as well. So there's three of us, and that one of us would be murdered, one would be the murderer, and one would be innocent. So we did leave lots of clues as well. So on the Zoom, we had little things, didn't we? So I changed my picture to some like, well, I shouldn't say we'll give things away,
yeah,
John.
Don't say. What we will do is we'll post that on the blog. So if you want to
see
what Stuart Turton could see, little clues.
Yeah, so we changed our names and stuff, haven't we? Yeah.
Do that before you listen and listen out carefully and see if you can work out who the killer
Why
is.
Why not? Why not?
Who the dead body is and who the innocent bystander is. Okay. Should we crack on then? Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast, Stuart. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. This must feel pretty great to you. It must feel like the culmination of everything.
Do you know what? Like, when I got your email, I was like, I've made it. I finally made it.
There was, you know, all those awards like the Costa, the Gold Dagger, now finally an invitation to the Failing Writers Podcast.
My wife was like, Stu, why are you crying? I couldn't tell her. I was too emotional.
No, we're genuinely thrilled to have you on. Thank you very much. I've got to ask you a question before we properly get going.
Before we start asking you questions.
Yeah, before we start
question. Yeah,
like
question.
It. This is what I'm in for.
So we're kind of assuming that being a murder mystery writer You quite like a puzzle.
No, No, cut you off right there. No, fuck that. No.
Well, that's a shame because as you're known for your wonderfully twisty plots, we thought we'd give this interview a little twist as well. Now, this might not work.
Almost certainly won't work.
But if you're up for it, throughout this chat, we're going to casually drop in some clues about a murder that has taken place.
Ooh.
And your job is to work out which one of us has been killed, who the killer is, and which one of us three is the innocent bystander.
I think it's Simply Dave. I've not heard a lot from Dave. I think Dave's dead.
I'm just a quiet person.
So you up for it anyway? Yeah. It's just a bit of silliness.
Yeah.
While we have a little natter.
Totally. Like you can't see me getting out my sort of like murder board on the wall, getting my pad out and taking it far too fucking seriously.
He's just licked his pencil. He's got his notebook flipped up. Okay, so boys, what's your first question?
Yeah. So if you think you're onto us, wait to the end to reveal who you think the killer is. We'll have a sort of Poirot-esque, we'll gather the suspects into the drawing room type chat and see if you got it right. I mean, there is, like I say, there's a pretty high chance this won't work.
You've got to take risks, haven't you, to get results?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you've got to, do you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Highway of podcast on the edge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this then. First proper question.
Well, we'll see. Go on.
I'll be the judge of this.
Well, it's one of my questions. My questions are a bit weird usually. Considering you're an internationally best-selling author, I couldn't help noticing a tweet of yours from July last year, which felt very apt for the Failing Writers podcast, and it went like this. This will come as absolutely no surprise to anybody who knows me, but I have no fucking clue what I'm doing. Buy one of my books, will you? At this rate, the next one will be along in 26 years.
He's a funny guy, isn't he?
Oh. And... Well, I think we could all identify with that.
Yeah.
But it's always really nice to hear that the professionals feel like that too. I was just going to ask you what do you struggle with specifically during the writing process?
It's all hard, and that comes across as kind of like slightly facetious, but it's all hard. The easiest bit is that 10 seconds before you start when everything's possible.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got all the ideas and it's brilliant and it's perfect and it's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
And then I've discovered, because I'm writing my third book now, I'm about to turn my third book in, and all the mistakes I made with my first book, I replicated in my second book and then made more mistakes. And then I'm writing my third book and I've made all the mistakes from the previous two books and added in some more again. And that's not even a joke. It's just like, it's this weird sort of like, the material that you're working with just keeps changing. Like, it's like, you know, you learn how to make pots out of clay and suddenly it's not clay anymore. You've got to make pots out of water and you've somehow got to work out to do that the second time. And the next time you do it, it's pots out of fire and you've got to do that. And that's the way it feels to me. Like every single book from start to finish, I have to screw everything up first before I get to what works.
Wow.
And to put this in perspective, the book I'm writing now is due at the end of this month, and I'm still at this point writing 6,000 words a day, fresh words, brand new words to get it finished, and I'm on my third draft. Like, so it's, I start books, tear them up, start a new book, tear that book up, start again, and that's what I do, three drafts.
Like wholly new book, or just like a completely different version of the same book?
Almost a completely different version. So for Devil, my second book, and for this one, I would say that 90% of it from first draft to second draft was a new book. So that's fresh writing, that's new writing, new character relationships, new everything. And then second to third draft is about maybe 50% or 40% is a new book. Wow. So that's entirely fresh writing. And again, that will be swapping character relationships around. It will even be sometimes changing the murder around and the murder and the reasons for the murder. Because in the writing, it hasn't worked. As I put it all down, that plan that I did, and once I put it down, I'm like, it doesn't work. It's not believable. It doesn't feel right. The characters have changed subtly, but importantly. And it has to be messed around with. So it's hell. The entire process is hell.
Sounds like hard work.
Mate, it's horrible, isn't it? Like, you guys know this, but you should, like, quitting Writers Podcast. I'll start it with you. That's what we should all do. Don't fail.
Well, I suppose
quit. Just stop just doing it. It.
Stop failing. Just quit. I suppose it begs the question then, doesn't it? Like, why, what keeps you going? Why keep going? Why do you do it if it's such hell? What drives
two
you
reasons.
On?
Two reasons. One, I'm shit at everything else. And two, it pays the bills. I think there's like, I say this openly and honestly everywhere I go, there is a financial imperative to writing that you can't often ignore. It takes so long to do this job. It's so hard. It's so intense. I can only do it if I'm getting paid. Like, I have to be paid to do it. I have to be paid relatively well to do it. Because otherwise, I could go off and be a barrister, or I could go off and be an architect. I could go off and do a number of other jobs. And it sounds very mercenary.
Yeah.
But, like, people ignore it. They think there's some magic to this job. And there is a certain magic to it. But there's also a certain starving magic to it. Like, if you're not getting paid, you're not feeding your bills. And I've got, I've got a young daughter. I've got a wife. I've got a house. I've got a mortgage. Like, it needs to pay the bills. So those two reasons, on the lowest of low days, I'll be like, this is how you make your money, fella. Just go and do your work.
Yeah, get on with it.
But that first book, that wasn't the reason for doing it, because you wouldn't, you're not necessarily going
to
make money.
No, but I was a journalist before that, so it sort of was the reason to do it. So I've always made money from words. That's always been my job. It's always been... Yeah. There's always been that cost calculation. So you put this amount of words down on paper, you get paid this amount of money. And that's the way I've always looked at it. So when I came to write the first book, I'd had that idea since I was a kid.
Like, yeah, well, were you just like drunk as a kid or something? As a kid, I had that idea. Did you get a bang on the head or like...
I had a very boring childhood. I think that's probably what it was.
Right, that's the other option.
Couldn't really think. No, like, it was so... I read a lot of Agatha Christie's when I was a kid. And
right,
then,
that figures,
So they imprinted, and I just thought that's what books were, and then I wanted to write an Agatha Christie book, and I sort of, like, I tried it when I was 21, and it was rubbish, and I went away and lived my life, but I was always thinking about it and thinking about what I could be doing with it, and Seven Deaths just kind of emerged out of that soup of, like, life plus looking for an original idea plus reading lots of the stuff. But that was always in the back of my head. So you were right what you said before. It wasn't initially a mercenary idea. It was very much sort of like, I'm a journalist, and I don't know if any of you lads know any journalists, but the sort of at the almost the end state of journalism is to write a book. It nearly always is. Nearly every journalist has got a book in a drawer somewhere, half a book. It just felt the natural evolution of what I've been doing for a career. So, but I took it to extremes and left the job and sort of like did a lot of other mad stuff to write the book. But it was very obvious early on that it was really hard to write that first book. And again, because I'd gone freelance, money wasn't exactly pouring in at that time because I needed a lot of time to write the book. I just got married and we were really struggling. So weirdly, that first book really cemented how this career had to go for me to carry on doing it. Like, it was just like, because otherwise I'd be divorced by now and through no fault of my wife's.
Failure is not an option. Well, it focuses the mind, doesn't it?
I was going to say, in terms of focusing the mind. So as you move through book two, book three, hopefully book four, who knows? We'll see. Is there do you end up putting a lot of pressure on you before to have kind of that killer idea? Is there a lot doing? What do you do in between when you go, right, that one's done, and then your publisher's going, right, what's next? What's your next great idea with a big twist?
Oh, you see, I don't think the ideas are the problem. Time is the problem.
All right, okay.
For me, I have ideas at the wazoo. Like so basically, I've got about 15 or 16 just written down on a desktop document, ready to go.
Right,
and it's about. There's loads of things, calculations that go into me sort of deciding what book I'm going to write next. Like I will, is it different enough to the last book that it's going to keep my interest? Are the characters different enough to the last set of characters that I wrote that they're going to keep my interest? Because at the heart of it, there always has to be a murder mystery. You always have to, some sort of detective, you always have to have a body, you always have to have a motive.
Yeah.
But past that, I'm very lucky with my publisher. She's very forgiving and I'm allowed to do sort of whatever I want around that sort of like around that nexus. So what will always happen, and the reason why my first drafts are so rubbish is because almost every idea I've possibly got, I'll put in the first draft. And it will be, they routinely come out at about 160,000 words, the first draft of my book.
Right, but that's a kind of a deliberate choice. You're kind of just chucking everything down, vomiting everything up.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant.
Going all ends. Honestly, it's both, it's literally all ends. It's like... It's vomit, it's poo, it's wax out the ears, it's tears, it's blood. It's
okay,
everything.
Stop. That's enough bodily fluids now. We can.
It's a messy business.
I was on a roll. I'm going to go and do some writing after this. It was. So I'll all chuck in every idea I've got and then I'll see kind of what interests me. So, yeah, honestly, my publisher doesn't put too much pressure on me for what comes next. I've got a 4-book deal and I think she's just. Her thing is that, like, I've never hit a deadline in my entire life. Like, I've never hit the second deadline. I've never hit the third deadline. You're very lucky if you get to six deadlines and I'm anywhere near them.
What happens when you go over a deadline? Does anything actually happen?
Yeah.
Does someone send you a shirty email or what happens?
No, they're really good about it. So my second book, Devil, missed, I think, 4 deadlines. My agent was the first one to get in contact, and he was like, is there a problem? And I was like, yeah, there is. Yeah, well, no.
Just one problem. One problem would be nice.
Yeah. So I just had a baby about 2 months after I started that book, so I had a newborn. Mm. And I'd just gone from sort of trying to wrap my head around this plot to having no ability to think whatsoever. But I carried on trying to write. Like, I honestly carried on trying to do the job, and it was horrific for a year. So there was things like that, and that was no problem. So they understood, and I basically, that book was delayed by a full year because I'd missed the first year.
Yeah.
And once I sort of explained to them what was going on, they were okay. Mm. And then this book is, again, I told you I replicated all my same problems. I thought that was because of my baby, and it turns out I did exactly the same thing this time. Like, I wrote the wrong book first for a full year. I had no excuses this time. Like, nothing's gone wrong in my life. It's all been dozy. And now I'm ripping it apart and ripping apart and finding out what works. So it's just part of the process. And I think they know that now. I think my publisher is just like, okay, what's a realistic date we can start talking about this? So, I mean, this book was due, I think it was scheduled to come out this summer. The summer gone. Then it was scheduled to come out the following summer. And now it's scheduled for February 2024. So that's kind of where we're at.
Probably be summer.
Yeah, no, it'll be. And honestly, when I said 2026, I was not. I was generally like, it could be 2026.
Do you think it's, but I mean, partly you've obviously chosen a genre that, I mean, it's sort of high concept mystery. It's a particularly difficult thing to write, I think. It's particularly knotty plotting.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, you guys must have this. I don't necessarily feel like, oh God, this is going to come across as pretentious author wank. So please edit this out.
Brilliant. But this is going in the clip we'll use on Twitter, probably. Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. The problem I have, I think, is that I've completely forgotten what I was about to say. What was the question? What are we talking about?
We're talking about
the genre that you've chosen is
particularly
tricky.
I'm sorry. I'm very stupid. I honestly didn't choose this. Like, it wasn't like I had a list of genres in front of me and thought, that's what I'm going to do. Like, I'll pick that one. That one will work for me. This is the only way I can write. Like, this idea of, like, my agent described it as high concept. I'd never heard of that until I delivered the manuscript to him and said, what do you think about this? I didn't know that was a thing. I just wrote because that was the interesting thing to write. And it went into the genres it went into because that's where the story was. And that's the story I was telling. And I naturally went into there. To the point where I'm utterly baffled by anyone who could write like a procedural detective novel, because I don't know how you stay in those boundaries. Like, that's a hell of a skill to me, to be able to sort of understand your genre so perfectly that you know how to operate within those boundaries and give your audience exactly what they want within those boundaries. So for me, because if my story sort of veers into romance, I write romance for 10 pages and then I'll come back to, maybe if I'd been professionally trained or something, maybe I'd have a better understanding of kind of what I'm doing. But a lot of it is instinctual. A lot of it's just kind of like being dragged around by the story and telling.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that because, you know, it does all seem very sort of intricately plotted. And I mean, I'm sort of desperately in need of a plot myself at the minute. But it reminded me of when we were talking to Jeremy Dyson about the sort of series 3 of The League of Gentlemen. And that seems like really intricately thought out and put together. Mm. And he said, no, we just had all these different strands and it just sort of came together at the end. So do you have that a similar kind of process where you just sort of work on different bits and it slowly falls into place? Or do you have a really clear idea of how it's going to come together when you start?
I have a very clear idea of how it's going to come together when I start, and then I start writing it and fuck that up totally. I plan everything and it nearly always goes wrong quite early in the writing.
I'd love to see one of the times where you planned it and it goes as planned. You're like, shit.
This is boring, isn't it?
What happens now? Yeah, hold on a minute.
My publisher gets a book in like 6 months and she's like...
And they're like, hold on a minute.
Yeah, exactly. But I do. So I do plan, and I plan intricately. And it came out that way in Seven Deaths, I think, because it absolutely had to in Seven Deaths. It didn't for Devil. It's not going to for this one. This one, especially the final book, is going to be completely different to the plan I put down. But each book, what I've got more than a plan sort of is a feel for how I want the audience to feel by the time they get to the end of it. I really like the idea of dense plotting, in the sense that like each character for me should be able to hold a book to themselves. Like if you wrote a book about that character, it should work. They should have an arc through the book which the audience could follow and would be interesting. They have their own things that they want, they have their own challenges. So I try to plot every character so they've got that, so that when the detective is investigating the crime, what they're actually doing, they're not finding red herrings. I hate a red herring. That's an author thing. That's like, that's an author messing with an audience. It's not in story, it's a very meta construct. What I want is a kind of like, I want all my characters to have stories, so the detective is constantly just solving the wrong mysteries. They're just kind of like bumbling, trying to get to the mystery they want, but they've got to get through all this other shit first. And like all of that is interesting, and all of that should be woven into the story, and it should tie into why these characters are in this place doing the things that they're doing, and it should never feel superfluous. But if you look at it very clearly, it's almost like you could pull that thread entirely out of the book and the book would still work. It should be fine. And that's why I love that. And I love the idea that when an audience goes back and reads the book again, they see things that they didn't see the first time. I love that sort of density.
It's a nice feeling, isn't it, when you sort of go back over and say, oh yeah, I thought that was something.
Yeah, exactly. So it's that.
Or even better when as a reader, as I did in The Seven Deaths, where you miss something that's bloody obvious because you're just reading.
Yeah.
And then it just smacks you and you go, oh, of course.
Yeah, it's because you're playing against the audience's training, right? So the audience is taught to just skirt through the book and sort of like trust the author. But like if you ask them to engage, that's a very different muscle to sort of like activate. And some readers really do that.
Yeah.
They will write things down, obviously, and they'll make notes and blah, 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 and do all the other stuff. I sometimes think of it as like, it's very similar to comedy. So especially like sitcoms, half an hour sitcoms, where it's about joke density. So like you miss four jokes because you're still laughing at the first joke. Yeah. It's like that, I feel, like clues that I want to stack a clue and then have four littler clues follow straight after it. So the audience is still thinking about the first one.
Okay, yeah.
And four have gone by them, and maybe the important one was the third one. So it's kind of that sort of stuff. But again, that's incredibly difficult to plot before you've written a word. So I'll often find that stuff while I'm writing, because I'll be like, oh, that character should be talking about this. These two characters could be bringing this up. It's important to them. And I'll never find that until I'm writing.
So what is that, when you're mapping a story out, what does it actually physically look like? Is this like a floor of post-it notes, or is it like a massive roll of wallpaper, or what? Or is it plotting software?
Spare room that looks like a serial killer lives in.
What does it
look first
like?
I go out into the world and I murder a person. And then I see it.
I like that. I think everyone should try that.
Yeah, it's way more practical than I was imagining.
Yeah, no, I'm very hands-on, honestly.
I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's authentic then, isn't it?
I think so. I think people think I just dial this shit in. But no. Yeah. There's quite literally blood on my hands, like, and skeletons in my closet. No, so the plans for all the books are completely different, because the plans and the planning for me sort of needs to reflect the tone of the book, which again is pretentious author wank, but they do. So Seven Deaths, because it was such an intricate novel, that was an Excel spreadsheet, and that was every 2 minutes of every character's day on a spreadsheet.
Wow.
So I knew where everybody was, and then I took all that information and I put it on a map of the house and grounds, which I'd drawn, and that was like a big sheet of paper, stuck it to the wall, and then I was like, right, this person, because that book, there should be no cheating in my books, there should be no sleight of a hand. I didn't want a character time warping across from the cemetery maybe to the house when that journey would have taken taken 10 minutes and it takes them 2 because I suddenly needed to take 2. I didn't want to do that.
I was going to say you could have probably got away with that, but I think that's me thinking in how stupid I am reading books, but you probably couldn't have got away with that, could you, with the way that some fans and readers, like you say, will take notes while they're reading, will delve into it, and then it would pop up on an internet forum at some. Well, actually, there's no way.
See, I was thinking how depressing it would be to plot my day on an Excel spreadsheet in 2 minutes. It'd just be completely blank.
Yeah, so that was the first book. But you're completely right. Like, I knew from the start going into that book that the promise I was making was that it was an Agatha Christie style mystery, and she always plays fair with her audience, so I had to play fair.
Yeah.
I knew that if it worked the way I wanted it to, people would want to read it again a second or third time, and if they did that, they would notice any shortcuts I took, they would notice when I cheated. That would blow the entire book apart. Like, they would never, that's all they'd ever talk about, it's all they'd ever say to people, it would never fucking end, right? Like, it would just be, And I think that's completely fair, because if you make a promise, you should honour it. Mm. And it's still to this day with Seven Deaths, it winds me up when I see like comments being like, oh, you know, well, there was these plot holes, and I'm like, there fucking wasn't. I will come round to your house.
Show me your plot holes.
I will fucking come round there with my spreadsheet, sunshine, and I will... Yeah, there's not a single one, because it was worked out so meticulously. Like, on that book, my publisher brought in a timeline editor, just to keep track of the timeline, and a normal story editor to sort of run through the story, because it was that intricate, and we wanted to make sure everything was there and worked. And of course, she'd read it, my agent read it, I'd read it, my beta readers had read it, everyone had read it. So that was that one. Devil, my second book, because that was a seafaring novel, it was supposed to feel more adventurous. It was supposed to be historical fiction, a bit more sort of like my publisher, Pirates of Caribbean, but I wanted something more authentic than that, but really sort of swashbuckling pirate novel, basically.
With more research involved in that one, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly. So there was tons of research in that, but that was fun, man. Like, that was really great. Like, I traveled out to Indonesia, I went out to Holland, I went to, climbed around boats, I was in the British Library for days, and it was great, and I enjoyed all that sort of stuff. But the planning for that, actually, I spent 3 months. I traveled and researched, and then I took all that information. And what I planned for that was I wanted more freedom than I'd had in Seven Deaths, because Seven Deaths writing that was very wearying after a while, because every day I knew what I was doing. Yeah, I knew exactly what I had to write. Was I wanted more freedom on Devil. So what I gave myself was these things I called lighthouses. So I planned it out. So the big plot points that I had to hit were lighthouses, but then I was free to get between them any which way I wanted. Was the idea. So you could have, you know, something massive happen. Obviously, you've got chapter one, something massive happens on chapter 16. Between chapter one and chapter 16, I was free. I could try out my characters interacting who I hadn't previously thought would interact, and who would be on this boat now, what would they be doing, would they get along, would they not? And that was great. That was all I ever had, was lots of characters just chatting with each other and taking the piss and getting along or fighting or whatever it was. And I found all that stuff in the writing. It was great. And I really enjoyed that. And it gave it that looseness and shagginess that I wanted from that story.
It's very, when I think about The Devil in the Dark Water, it's very visual. I can almost, I can sort of see it in my head like a graphic novel. It's got a larger than life quality to it, if you know what I mean by that.
Oh, thank you.
In a good way. Yeah. I read it very quickly. It's one of those books that you just sort of have to keep reading, even when you're knackered and you know you should be getting some sleep.
Oh, cheers, pal.
So what was the starting point for that book? Where did that spring from?
That was, I wanted to go in a completely opposite direction to The Seven Deaths, was actually the starting point for that, which is a bit of a weird starting point. But I was aware that Seven Deaths came out and did really well. And I knew just from conversations and just from looking at a bit of Twitter that everyone wanted the 8 deaths and the 9 deaths and the 10 deaths. And that's what people had like sort of laid out for me. And I wanted to make it very clear straight off the bat that I was never going to be that guy. That's not what I'm going to do. They're not the books I'm writing. And I wanted that to be clear for everyone. So like, my publisher was really good, but I just wanted to make sure for her that she understood that I'm not going to do that again. We're going to we can go forwards, we can go backwards, we can go side to side, we can go whatever I think is an interesting story. And I'd come across the idea for this when I was traveling, when I was 21. So it'd always been in my head, and I was fascinated by the period, and I was fascinated by the occult. All this stuff that you talk about has been larger than life. A lot of that actually just came out of the research, and it came out of the period, and it came out of the idea that I wanted to turn all that into a grand swashbuckling novel. And it was quite naturalistic, but that the starting point was generally that. It was like, no, I'm not your sort of like, time travel, body hopping, murder mystery guy for like the next 20 years.
Yeah,
like,
well, that's the thing, isn't it? If you do two of those, then that's it. You're about it.
I mean, yeah, and then
I thought, for a while, I thought there was a sequel because I saw The 7.5 deaths. So that was the American version. Why did they do that? Why did they call it that? Was it just because they like imperial measurements?
I mean, there's two things in that, right? One, the spoilers. If anyone's listening to this, the spoilers about to come up for Seven Deaths. So, you know, turn off now and then come back to us in a minute. But like, the Seven Deaths is obviously a play on words, right? Because you learn at the end the 7 deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle are the 7 murders committed by Evelyn Hardcastle, not the 7 times that she's died. That's the joke of that title. So the idea was that the biggest clue of the book is on the title. You've read it before you even get into, and I don't know if that's picked up by everybody, but like
no it's not, Stuart.
Oh, right, okay.
Well, you could have brought that a bit more gently now. I feel really stupid.
Sorry, mate. Like,
I mean, I have to say, I'm guilty. I don't read that much at all. So you should feel very honoured that I actually read your book.
Well, thanks very much.
But yeah, that completely passed me by.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
Thank you for flagging that up.
What will happen now is you'll go back trying to make out whether that's bullshit or not. But how many times did you tell? No, there's definitely eight. But no, that was the idea. So the entire thing was a joke. It was a play on those words. And it was the idea that I'd given you the biggest clue before you get into the book.
Oh, you bugger.
Yeah, exactly. It was what we talked about earlier, right? Dense layer of clues. So then the US are like, we're changing it to 7.5. And I'm like, you're not. No, you can't. Like,
startlingly, you've missed all the nuance and subtlety, America. Yeah. How did that happen?
You are killing me here. But they did have a good reason for doing it because it came out in the US about a year after it came out here, maybe a little bit less. And in the intervening time, The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo would come out by Taylor Jenkins Reid, which had been massive, absolutely massive. And they were just worried that people would conflate the two books, confuse the two books. And we went round the houses, honestly, for months trying to come up with a new title. They were like, we'd like a new title. And I was like, well, I ain't got one. Like, it took me years to come up with this one. And they were like, try. And we ended up, we had some real shit on there. Like, we had, because everyone was so desperate, like, titles were coming flying across, being like, oh, we'll call it The Everlasting Life of Evelyn Hardcastle. And I was like, have you seen what happens to her?
Where's that come from?
But that's like a, you know, it's a marketing title because there would have been another book out similarly at that time that was about somebody living multiple, I don't know. So it's stuff like that. Yeah. And it was like, and all these titles, and we were getting increasingly aggro with each other, me and my US publisher, because we couldn't up with the title. And eventually the CEO of my US publisher just stepped in and was like, we're calling it The 7.5 Deaths, done, the end, we're not doing this anymore. So it was more just sort of like a title that would placate both sides, but it hasn't worked. Like, I've had people coming up to me at festivals with like telling me the story of how they bought Seven Husbands instead of Seven Deaths, or they bought Seven Deaths for Seven Husbands. There was one lovely old guy who'd bought The Seven Deaths, The Seven Husbands and The 7.5 Deaths thinking they were a trilogy. He'd bought them for his daughter. she'd wanted seven husbands.
They got the same number.
Oh, it's brilliant. It was so nice. So he got me to sign all of them. I tried to explain to him, but it wasn't working. So it didn't work at all. But people seem to be relatively happy. There seems to be a very strange overlap of people who like Seven Husbands and like Seven
Maybe
Dads.
They just like the number. Maybe they
could be.
Favourite film, Seven.
Yeah.
Favourite shop, 7-Eleven. It's just, that's just maybe, what they do.
Maybe their age. My favourite age, 7.
Yeah.
Yeah. Possibly. Yeah. Maybe it's just like we've cracked it and all you've got to do is call every book the 7 something.
Something 7.
Something 7.
Enid Blyton was there years ago.
Yeah,
limited success with The Famous Five, but I tell you what.
Make it a secret. Everybody wants to know about it.
Oh my God, she's a genius.
Yeah, she's nailed it. Absolutely. Back the racism. She's on top of both.
Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Thanks for listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. Here's more of the Failing Writers Podcast. Coming up on the Failing Writers Podcast.
Stuart, I'm trying to write a murder.
No, no. What are you doing?
It's quite difficult, isn't it? But I think what I've realised is, especially after your comment before, is what's clever about your stories. Partly is that you've managed to avoid all that annoying police business.
Yes.
That is frankly a massive pain in the arse and means that you can waste ages just researching how the police go about solving crime, which isn't that interesting to research, rather than cracking on with the characters and the plot.
We all started writing a police procedural type thing, didn't we, as part of a task we'd set ourselves in season one.
Yes.
And John and Dave, to be fair, carried on with it. And we all had a stab at it. I had a stab at it and kind of gave up because I realised as soon as I had to go on Wikipedia to find out who was what in the police force in terms of
rank.
I really didn't know the basics. And trying to paint any kind of police procedural after that was just a waste of time. So yeah, I think sidestepping that is a good call. You've got enough to deal with.
I hit a flat line.
I'm now thinking I really should have gone down the Golden Age detective novel, I think. It would have been.
It's a purely marketing thing at the moment. Like, if you're trying to write a police procedural, there's already 1,000 on the market that you're competing with automatically. And same with Golden Age now. There's tons of Golden Age stuff coming out. So, like, again, if you're going to write a Golden Age, you sort of need to put the market's all over the place, isn't it? Like, again, what you need to do, I think, is just find characters who work for you and find sort of like some sort of plot or something, but one thing that works for you, just write it and hope for the best, because like otherwise you are going
to
get
it's got to be written from you, hasn't it? Not trying to fill some niche.
To be fair, that is exactly what I'm doing, because I don't know anything about the police. I'm just writing it and hoping that this is what the police do. And at some point in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, I'll find out, you know, eventually, and you know, tweak it here and there.
massive rewrite in a year.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely ridiculous because, of course, everything in a detective novel relies on everything that's gone before. So any little detail,
it's like the butterfly effect of the story. Yeah.
It totally is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not how they do forensics. What? So that just pulls this thread through the entire thing.
That would be amazing as well if, like, you know, chapter 2 to chapter 47 could have just been done by a computer in 5 minutes. It's like, fuck! Shit!
But then instead of solving it, you just come up with some really clunky plot device to, oh no! All the computers are out. Yeah. Right, carry on.
Yeah, the killers smashed all our police computers. Don't even find out what they're called. He's just smashed all the police computers. We can't use the police computers anymore.
And he's turned off the internet.
He's using an internet blocker.
It'd be like sort of like time travel caveman comes from the past to solve a murder in the future.
Oh, there you go. That's good.
It's done. Yeah, and he doesn't know how to use computers, so he can't. He just grunts and hits things with a club, which is actually very much what the police do.
Well, it's always got to come from something you're interested in, hasn't it? And there always seems to be a bit of a supernatural sort of element in your books, which is something I've sort of recently become interested in. But have you like always been into the supernatural? You mentioned the occult earlier on about one of the books. Is that just an area that sort of piques your interest?
Yeah, I think no. I'm the most boring bastard you'll ever meet. Like I am rational to a fault. I can't deal with UFOs. I can't deal with ghosts. I can't deal with the supernatural. I can't deal with religion. I can't deal with any of this. Like, what I can deal with is clever people being clever and coming to solutions through that. I love science. I love that search for like this impossible truth that's out there somewhere that you've got to constantly devise methods to even remotely get near, let alone get to. And that's what I want the detectives to do as well. The reason why I'm fascinated by the occult is because I'm fascinated by the idea that people could believe it. It's the same reason I'm equally fascinated by religion. Like, I really cannot understand why people can believe it. So I'm fascinated by trying to get into the head of somebody who does and understand why they don't, understand what's in them that requires that faith, what's in them that requires them to believe that if they, you know, if they throw salt over the shoulder, they'll have a good day, or if they, on devil, if they get on the boat and do this thing that they have to do, they will have a good life. Like, the superstitions wrap themselves around all of us. They wrap themselves around our society, even a modern rational society like ours. They're all still woven through it. And it's in us. It's in every one of us, which means we're bonded by it, which means it's recognisable by all of us, which means it's something that's worth writing about, because everybody will see it in the novel and have a thought about it. And that's a lovely communal thing to do with your writing.
Yeah.
It's the idea that when you're at your worst moment, the first thing you say, you first think people pray. They'll just pray. Like, they've never prayed before, they'll pray, because something bad's about to happen, and it's a sort of wild toss of a coin. And then I'm fascinated by the idea that if it comes so somebody you love's in the hospital, you pray for their survival, the person survives, do you then believe? Is there a bit of you that is then forever tainted by that moment and forever has belief?
Yeah, you've always got to pray then, haven't you? Because otherwise you're doing people a disservice.
But then I always think it's weird when people pray for sports games or something like that, as if how does that work? Is there like a totting up system? So God goes, well, that side's had more prayees. They prayed more. So I am going to lead. Oh, no, a minute. There's a few more coming in from the other team.
And they're louder.
Right. Yeah. It's just weird, the idea that people think they can pray for stuff.
Yeah.
Well, presumably, if there is a God and he was infinite or she was infinite, then they would just support the first football team, right? That would be just the first one that popped up.
Because
that's me.
That would be their team because that's what happens, isn't it? The first one you get attached to becomes your team wherever you are.
Which, again, then that first football team is probably long out of business, thus disproving the existence of God. So I think we've nailed it. Sorted.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
That sounds right,
but I don't think God does support Notts County. So I think probably... Yeah.
Wait. That music's for me, not you. Sit back down, please. You've still got some more of the Failing Writers podcast to listen to.
talking about the sort of mechanics of writing and getting in sort of, because Tom and I had a conversation the other day, but I can't remember how it ended for some reason, but we're talking about, like, you've got to get comfortable, you've got to get sort of right. Do you have like a sort of favorite desk or a chair or a setup that sort of gets you in the flow? Well, like, where do you do your writing?
Like Roald Dahl's shed.
See, I disagree. I've got a massive problem with this. Like, I disagree entirely with the idea that you've got to get comfortable, you've got to get right. You don't. You just got to start writing. That doesn't matter where you are. Like, the hardest part about writing is writing, but the second hardest part is starting writing. Mm, yeah. And the only way you do that is literally, it's just to open your laptop or turn on your computer and open a document and just start writing. And if you can do that before your brain switched on, you'll have a great day. Like, I genuinely believe that. Before you've talked yourself out of it, before you've decided you need to look at the sports score, or like whatever it is that you do in the morning, like, I make a cup of coffee, I open my laptop and I start writing, and I don't give my brain time to catch up. Because then you started, and once you've started, you're all right. You can go, you can be away.
Yeah.
But if I have to sort of think about, making myself comfortable, I've been in the right spot, then that I'm already thinking about the wrong things. Yeah. I'm already distracted. I'm already on something else.
It's already another reason not to do it, isn't it? This or that or the other.
Yeah.
Rather than just cracking on regardless.
But again, I think that comes out of journalism, because in journalism, you don't have time to get comfortable, because you've interviewed someone you're writing the story on the train back or the bus back, or like you're on a plane or you're in a, you know, you're never in the right place to be writing.
No, well, I think we all understand that as guys that have written local radio ads, that you kind of just have to put into the gaps.
That's it. I mean, when I had the idea for Seven Deaths, I was on a flight and it was about 2 a.m. and I was flying from, I used to live in Dubai, and I was flying from Qatar to Dubai, or Dubai to Qatar, I can never entirely remember, but it was like a short haul flight. And I remember I slightly fell asleep and I was dozing and I'd just eaten some shitty food. I remember the idea came as a whole, like, what about if that? And I opened the laptop up and just very quickly wrote about 2,000 words of it, just 3,000 words. It never went anywhere near the book. It was just about trying to sort of amalgamate a stranger seeing through somebody else's eyes and having a chat with themselves almost. And I just wrote it down as a sort of like proof of concept to see if it would work. That was exactly the same thing. Like, if I'd waited for that idea, I genuinely think I would have lost it, or I would have lost the spark that convinced me it was a good idea.
What was it that you ate? Perhaps it was a magic food. If you've eaten some bad food, what was it that got you?
Some weird airline food.
One of those like chicken things that is basically
generic rubber. Chicken. Some really salty, potato gratin.
Well, they have to make it more salty because your taste buds change depending on the altitude.
Oh, that's great.
Airline food is more salty.
It's really salty, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do they do that with the alcohol as well? Do they make it more boozy? Because I'm always absolutely smashed on a flight after one glass of wine.
I think the altitude probably doesn't help, depending on whether you're looking to get drunk or not. I think the altitude would probably help with that as well.
My friend's got he loves being drunk on a plane, and I cannot think of anything worse. I just like altitude surrounded by people and me getting increasingly leery. Sounds like my
I noticed on your Wikipedia page, it said, in November 2020, Turton signed a contract to write 2 more high-concept mystery novels for Bloomsbury. He has described them as nuts. So you're obviously not changing tack here. How far along are you actually? You're not writing 2 at the same time. I'm guessing you're focusing on this one, the one that you're wrapping up at the moment. Or is the other one sort of partly in the mix? How does it work?
No. So the third, I'm planning the fourth one while I write the third one. Not anymore, because this one's now so intense. I'm finishing this one up, but usually I'll be sort of planning the next one, or have an eye on it, or I'll think about what I want to be doing. And it's a self-defense mechanism, because usually I'm so sick of the book I'm writing by the time I get to the end of it. Exactly. It's like planning a holiday when you're just about to finish a holiday, isn't it? I know exactly what the next book is going to be, which means to say that it'll come out in 9 years and be completely different.
Are you allowed, presumably you're not allowed to say anything about it, I'm guessing?
No, to be honest, no one's ever said anything, but I wouldn't anyway, just because I'm really, really lucky. Like, nobody knows what I'm going to write next. I do write in a specific genre, but I don't write in a specific time period. I don't write the same characters. I'm not part of a series. I can go anywhere I want within that time. So I can surprise the reader with almost every single part of the book. Like, the moment you open a page or read the blurb on the back or see the cover, it can be a surprise. And I love that in books. I want my books to be totally surprising, top to bottom, every single part of it, not just the mystery, everything. So, like, where we're going together and who we're going with and what happens when we get there. So, yeah, I would never, I would never give any sort of, like, pre-blurb to people just because it would take one of those surprises.
But we can expect more of the same kind of thing, or...
books.
Yeah, presumably they are books.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not moving into Panto or anything. Like, oh, that would be fucking great. A murder mystery Panto. Oh, he's behind you. No, he's not dead.
I'd love to see you as you submit that to your agent and publisher. There you go.
it's taken me 3 years, that.
Yeah. That's probably where this book will end up being by the time I'm done editing it. Again, what was the question? What were we talking about before we got to murder mystery Panto?
Books and stuff and things.
No, I don't even know if we asked the question.
Yeah, just the next book. What we should expect. But you can't say anything anyway, so that's a moot point. Let's move on.
Yeah, no, it'll be murder mysteries. There'll be a body, a detective, and there'll be some sort of like...
some shenanigans, smoke and mirrors, and...
That's it.
Oh, all that business.
Tom's in my head. I'm terrified. It's in my head. It's reading out my thoughts as I think them.
So is that what you'd want your literary legacy to be if it was on your book gravestone? I don't know. Do they have those? That you kind of... people didn't know what was coming next.
Oh, mate, like, no one's going to remember me in 2 weeks, let alone, like, 20 years. Like, no, it doesn't matter. Like, you're sort of mostly... at least I'm mostly writing for myself. Like, as I said... this is my job. I treat it like my job. Like, I'm very lucky to do it. I don't know if the stuff I've said tonight comes across as a sense of like entitlement. I hope it doesn't. I genuinely do believe I'm very lucky to do this, and I know how hard it is. And I know that not everybody gets this opportunity. And I'm not sort of by any means wishing I was doing anything else. This is what I'm good at, and I do actually enjoy this.
That's
but
fair enough,
it is a job for me, and it's sort of about sitting down and sort of doing the work and coming up with something that's entertaining. But for me, I have to sit down and do this. And like, if I'm going to work till 2 o'clock in the morning, which I'll be doing tonight, I've got to believe that what I'm doing is worthwhile, that it's different, that it's exciting, that people will enjoy it. I'm not one of those authors who can claim he doesn't write to be read. I do write to be read. I want people to read my books. I want as many people as possible to read my books and enjoy them, because those people will buy them and then I'll be able to pay my mortgage. Yeah. But I don't want, like, you know, I don't want to put a book out and have thousands of negative reviews either. Like, I want to write something that people genuinely enjoy and talk about and get something out of. So,
yeah,
that's me. That's kind of me.
Well, it seems to be working
quite
well, I think. Good so far, anyway. Let's see what the next one. Let's see what the next one is.
Yeah. Only as good as your last book.
Still time to fuck it up. Well, I'm definitely doing the sort of like time traveling caveman.
Oh, I thought you'd given me that one.
You've lost that one, John. You've lost that one.
Oh, no, I'm having that back. We can co-write it. It'll be absolutely fine. You can tell me all your police stuff.
Brilliant.
All of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I won't take long. That won't take long. Well, unless you fellas have got another burning question, I think that's a nice place to wrap up the chat.
No, the only question I had, one more question, was... are people reticent to play Cluedo with you now that you know?
Oh, we never played your game, your murder mystery game.
Oh, we've been playing it all the time, Stuart.
Oh,
we've been playing
very
it all
nice
the time.
Been got you.
The clues are there.
Oh shit, there's been a death, a demise, a final breath. But we don't know who's done what to whom, or if they'll confess. Can Stuart Turton draw back the curtain? He thinks Dave's hurting, but nobody seems very certain. We try to make it atmospheric, ended up too esoteric. Stuart's never gonna get it, so we might as well end the song.
Well, I wasn't remotely paying attention.
That's what we hoped.
Right, okay. Well,
that's the only way it would work.
Should we go through to the drawing room?
Yeah, okay.
Let's retire.
All right.
Jeeves has lit the fire. Please come through here, Stuart. Can I offer you a drink?
Oh, yes, please.
Single malt?
Old-fashioned, please.
Old-fashioned, certainly. And Yeah, so all there is to do really is to finally ask you, Stuart, have you any ideas which of us is dead, which of us is innocent, and which of us is the killer? Any ideas at all?
Right. Well, here's what I've got going for me. We've got a butler, we've got a car, and we've got the Rand. So I think this has got something to do with international currency being moved in the car, overseen by the butler, who was killed, and then we've got somebody impersonating his voice afterwards. And then I reckon it was likely... So I was the quiet ones. It was probably me. That sounds about right.
Tell you what.
I'll tell you what, that is a much better story than we came up with.
Yeah, we might
so it's clear who the writer
one.
Is
yeah,
here.
Yeah, we'll stick with that one. Yeah. Well done, Stuart. You got it right. That's exactly what we thought.
Absolutely spot on.
No. Who did it? What was going on?
It was the butler.
Yeah,
Tom.
The butler.
Tom
the
did
butler
it.
Did it. The butler always does
Dave,
it.
Yeah. Dave has been talking about being dead quite a lot, very subtly. I thought you did a beautiful job, Dave.
Yeah.
And his name here is an anagram of cadaver as well.
Yeah. Hey, Stuart, I'll tell you something, Stuart, with all your fancy things in the seven deaths that fooled me. I fooled you because my name's not even Butler.
What's your name? Tom Turner.
Yeah. Oh, you knew it. Yeah. Hold on a minute. Yeah. Come on now.
Or did I fool you this whole time? I'm knee deep in this conspiracy. Actually, me, John, and Dave conspired against you, my friend. That's right. Yes.
He's actually been pulling the strings all along, Stuart.
If you're lucky in the other room, your dog's dead.
Oh, yeah. Man.
That's why the crows are circling.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. So hang on. Why did this happen? So I just thought... hang on. So Dave is talking about death all the time, right? I just assumed he needed counselling. So, like...
I'm just getting into character. Yeah.
I was going to send you something off mic, being like, hey, mate, maybe this will help you out. But...
Yes. Yeah. It's too late. It's far too late for me.
Yeah.
I've been dead for years.
That's just how Dave talks all the time.
So why did Tom kill Dave? Apart from the usual,
just doesn't like me very much.
Just
basically,
just for crap, really, wasn't it? Just for
right,
someone had to die. Someone had to die for this episode to happen. So it was
honestly, lads, this is a focus on plot over character, isn't it? Honestly, Jesus Christ. Honestly, it's like we did the
We just needed someone to be dead.
Yeah.
Once we got rid of once you're gone, Stuart, we're going to edit all the bits that we said and put them in a little montage so it sounds really obvious. So people are going, oh my God, I can't believe he didn't get that and he came up with that crazy plot.
By the time we're finished, we're going to sound really clever.
I don't know if we can do that much editing.
<It's>, no.
Well, listen, thank you for playing our little game. Our extremely stupid.
Thank you for bringing yourself down to our level.
I'm happy to be here. This has been delightful. Thank you so much.
Oh, bless you. We really appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for talking to us.
Very much looking forward to the next Stuart Turton book. We'll keep our eyes out for it.
Oh my God, he could be the first person who I read two books of since I read Biggles when I was a kid.
Fucking hell. Now I truly am.
Serious.
Like a full serious.
So I'm genuinely honoured now.
Book.
Now I feel super amounts of pressure to make this one good. I was happy with it being just a bit shit, but now...
No, it can't be. Can't be.
Oh, great. I'm going to ring my wife now and say I'm never coming out of this room.
Not now.
Just till this book's finished. It's good.
Two things. I'm never coming out of this room. I'm never doing another bloody podcast either. We get that a lot.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that because, it does all seem very sort of intricately plotted. And I mean, I'm sort of desperately in need of a plot myself, at the minute.
Well, first, I go out into the world and I murder a person.
Yeah,
murder
no, big, a I'm a big fan yeah, of that.
Murder a person.
Because Tom and I had a conversation the other day about... I can't remember how it ended for some reason.
I have to say, I'm guilty.
I hit a flat line with it all.
Nice to have Dave back, wasn't it?
It was. Davey back in the fold.
A little bit of Dave.
I thought he did a lovely job of being dead as well, didn't he?
He did. He did put some good clues in there.
He did. There were comforting aspects to that chat, i.e. just how hard writing is.
Yeah.
And the fact that everybody suffers, similar doubts and struggles. But it was also another one of those interviews that's a little bit perturbing as well.
Why is that?
Well, firstly, how much work goes into writing a murder mystery.
Yeah.
And also the fact that that's another person who writes a book and then pretty much deletes it and starts again.
Oh, I know. That hurts every time, that, doesn't it?
It makes the craft of writing just seem that little bit more unattainable, I think. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if I have to do that to get to the, you know, to become a bestseller, I don't know. I don't know if I've got that in me.
Yeah.
Obviously, everyone doesn't do that. But I think if you've got a, you know, a complicated high concept book, then it probably does require a hell of a lot of rewriting and rejigging and getting it exactly right.
Yeah. But I think the answer is to write something low concept, isn't it? So you don't have to.
That is clever, yeah.
Ironically, that is clever.
Hey, listen, we've had the first entry into our little, what would we call it?
What are we going to call it? We need to call it something now because people have been sending us stuff.
What was I thinking the other day? Get your whips out.
Oh, right, yeah. Good play on the word whips. Whipped into shape.
Whipped into shape's good.
The working title, anyway. Yeah, so we asked people that are listening to see if they were going to be brave enough to send in basically the first couple of chapters of what they're working on or something they've just finished that they're going to send off. Or
just their premise.
Yeah.
If that's what they want to send.
So several people have, which is nice, isn't it?
Yeah. Which is amazing, really, that they're sending some stuff to us in order to give constructive criticism, considering we're not even remotely qualified to do that.
I know, I did think that when I was reading it. I was writing down little notes and thinking, why people? I mean, come on.
I mean, it just makes the feature more interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The fact that we really don't know what we're talking about. But I feel like we've learned a lot. You know, I feel like we can pass on other people's advice.
And we're going to keep it nice and short and sweet, aren't we? Kind of.
Yeah, of course we are.
So the first person that sent us something in was Craig Margolis, who actually won one of our competitions last year.
He did.
Or the year before, or at some point in the past. And so he sent us in sort of the first three, and he promised short chapters. First three short chapters of a book that he's working on.
Yeah.
Currently in progress, is that
exactly
right?
Exactly, yeah.
So like I said, we said we'd have a look at it and he asked for some honest feedback.
And we're going to give it.
I know, it feels a bit weird, doesn't it?
But, it does.
Yeah, Craig. So obviously be listening. It was a bit shit. is that too short or? I'm kidding, Craig. I'm kidding. Goodness me. Where do we start, John? Where do we start?
I'm going to start.
No, do you know what we should start with? Before we rip this to shreds, here is an excerpt read beautifully by Mr. Jonathan Rand.
The Bergschule would be Adolf's first sustained foray among the other citizens of the city. And his separateness was immediately apparent from the first day of his public education. Laden with books, Adolf waddled down the main hall. He was short for his age, and the pile reached to his nose as he struggled to pilot the way ahead. Adolf did not see, but distinctly heard, a pocket full of pfennigs fall at his feet. Peering around the book pyramid, Adolf spied a gathering of distinctly unfriendly-looking lads. Rather than press on, he gently placed his pile on a nearby bench and reached down to gather the coins.
"Told you he would,"
their chief declared to the laughter of his crew. Adolf straightened up, approached the leader, and held out his palm. "You lost these." This confused the brute. He snatched them back and threw the coins rather more violently. As was to be expected, the Jew reached down and scooped up the pfennigs, though he again returned them, defying type and tradition. No more funny business. The Goliath straightened up to his full height, two heads taller than Adolf, and balled the coins into his fist.
"You will take these, Jew boy, either way. You want to eat them instead. From the look of you, you're always hungry."
This witticism layered rotundity atop religion in a powerful double insult. As the bully grabbed Adolf's collar as prelude to prying open his mouth, there was another voice heard above the din.
"Hans, leave the kid alone."
It came from an even taller youth, sandy-haired and hazel-eyed, a perfect specimen of Germanity.
"This ain't none of your business, butt out!"
"I've made it my business," said this Siegfried reborn. "You put that hand down or I'll do it for you. Why don't you use those pfennigs to buy yourself some cake? Judging by your middle, I'm sure you're just as hungry as he is." Hans glanced at his own bulging belly. his face darkening to purple.
"Not seen the last of me, Jew boy,"
he murmured before skulking off. Adolf's newest hero stepped up and thrust out his hand. "You're new here. I'm Koenig, Franz Koenig. Kaplan, Adolf Kaplan." He wiped his sweaty palm before presenting it. "Thank you."
"It was nothing. He's mostly talk. Come, let me help you with those."
Franz took half the books and walked alongside Adolf.
"How do you know about me?"
Adolf asked.
"That you're a Yid.
The headmaster told us one was coming, so Hans must have been on the lookout. A lucky guess, I reckon." Adolf considered how many other new kids may have been showered before Hans got to him.
"Yeah, lucky's the word for it."
"Bet you're the first one Hans has ever saw," Franz said.
"Pretty sure first for me, too. What do you think?"
Franz deposited Adolf at his next class with a smile. "Early signs look good." Adolf steered clear of Hans and his gang, but not of Franz. First for protection, later for friendship. The two could not have been more different. Where Adolf was bookish, Franz was athletic. The one studious, the other streetwise. Of rules, a follower, and a bender. They got along famously. Adolf excelled at arithmetic, and he spent many a lunch hour helping Franz puzzle out problems. In turn, Franz kept Adolf in tow on the track, their coach frowning.
"Faster, Koenig! Don't let him slow you down!"
the gaffer bellowed while wobbling alongside on a rickety bicycle.
"Don't know what you mean, Herr. I'm running my fastest,"
Franz said, without a hint of exertion, before whispering to Adolf,
"Come on, race your back."
Adolf flew, truthfully, only a hair quicker than before Franz's challenge. Nevertheless, he remained a few steps behind, allowing Adolf a small victory. During school assemblies, when Franz thought them safely lost in the crowd, he urged Adolf to take unscheduled leave.
"There's a Western at the pictures, only a pfennig apiece. We'll get caught. No, I will get caught. You get away with everything."
"Never know we're gone,"
Franz pleaded.
"Come on, Wolfie. It's the newest thing from America. Something about a train robbery. Maya's first for sweets."
Mouths full of candy, Adolf and Franz soaked in the flashing pictures. The matinee audience, comprised mainly of other suspiciously available schoolchildren, gasped collectively as a bandit leapt from horse to locomotive, guns drawn on the engineer. The train ground to a halt as the bandit and his compadres duked it out with the guards over bags of loot. The outlaws jumped back to their mounts for the getaway, a sheriff and posse seen over the horizon giving chase. The parting shot was of robbers riding off into the sunset, their fate uncertain as the screen faded to black. Best 10 minutes a pfennig could buy. They left the theatre, squinting against the late afternoon sun. "Think we have to go back?" Franz asked.
"Nah, assembly's over by now. Dismissal in 5 minutes. If we're caught, we're dead already."
They walked along the Pragel, in no particular direction, taking turns with the bag of sweets. With a pinch of bravery, Adolf cleared his throat and began his own Adolf Meiser.
"You know, my cousin's a cowboy."
"You don't say?"
"Yep, a cattle rustler even. Fishke the Goniff."
"What's a Goniff?"
"A thief. He got caught nabbing a cow in Russia, dug his way out of the village jail and stowed away on a ship to America."
"Right."
"Swear, off to the west. Nobody knew him, so he wasn't caught. Tried his hand as a cowboy and before too long fell into his old ways. Turned to rustling. Started his own gang with the Indians."
"Come on, Adolf. How did Fustke know how to talk to Indians?"
"Fishke, and he could. Because they're Jews."
"They're what?"
"Jews, I tell you. Didn't you hear in church about the lost tribes? Well, one of them made a ship. Like Noah's Ark, but bigger. They sailed until they couldn't sail anymore. Made it all the way to the New World. They had babies like rabbits. And before too long, they spread all over."
"Yeah? Then why don't they look like you?" Adolf thought this one over while he stalled for an answer.
"'Cause they're outside all the time. You saw the movie. It's the desert there, so they're always sunburned. Anyway, Fishke got caught cheating at poker, and he had to run to the hills. Before he knew it, he was surrounded by Indians. A goner, he started to pray. Jewish prayers. The Indians recognized one of their own, and he was saved. Then he and his new friends became cattle rustlers, ruled the whole territory, their very own Jewbraska, or something like that."
So let's talk about it, first of all, because we should say that the working title is Another Adolf.
Yeah.
And the log line he sent is, Adolf Kaplan's beloved bub warned him the life of a healer was both blessing and burden. As a pharmacist in golden 20s Berlin, he found plenty of both. That is, until the rise of that other Adolf and his National Socialists forced him to make a terrible choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, John, what were your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts were, first of all, just how nicely, I mean, that sounds so trite, but just how well Craig writes.
He is a crafter, isn't he? He's a crafter.
He is a proper crafter. It's that old thing that Tim said about feeling like you're in safe hands. You're put into this locale and you meet the characters and you're given so much sort of creamy backgroundness that fills out the picture before you. Interestingly, that was the sort of first thing I thought. And then the second, almost immediately after, was, is this all the sort of research and stuff that you do, and you do lots of writing based on the background of these people, and then is that the first thing you throw out sometimes? Like, is this definitely the beginning of the book?
Yeah, that was my main
That's what I thought.
Critique, actually, was that it just all feels a bit exposition-y at the start.
Yeah.
And it kind of a little bit harder to get through, because when you break through that into when sort of the action starts, when there's characters interacting, it just seems to flow so much easier and quicker.
And you get into the book then, you're into the characters.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted it to start in the middle of some of the action. And I think it kind of deals, it's very sort of first draft in that it deals with it. I hope it is a first draft, otherwise that's quite a criticism, isn't it?
No, I think you're probably right.
That it feels very chronological.
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't need to be. I want to be jolted about a bit more. Mm. I want to hear his childhood where he gets bullied in school, and then I want to flip back to see where that came from, rather than being fed that information and end up in that place.
Or even more, I mean, obviously this is a story about him being a pharmacist. So he's, most of the book, I'm guessing, is when he's older. It's set when he's older.
Yeah.
So maybe we sort of flash back to when he's a kid, or do you know what I mean? It's like we're not in the nuts and bolts of the story. I think we need to get there. And then you could maybe show us some bits from the past. Because obviously the fact that he's this storyteller, it feels like that's obviously going to be a pretty key part of the book. That's going to get him into a lot of trouble, I'm guessing. And it's also going to get him out of a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But I don't think we need to know everything about where that came from.
No, it felt a bit of a helicopter narrator at the start, didn't it? Where you're kind of seeing everything rather than being in the story. And you felt like you kind of went into the story and you're being carried along by it, whereas that kind of first bit definitely felt like a bit of an overview. Sort it out, Craig. Jeez.
But he's such a good writer. And, you know, a lot of that stuff, you could probably lose quite a lot of the sort of family history stuff. In fact, it reminded me of the book, How Not to Write a Novel.
This is going well, isn't it, Craig?
No, but there's a little section in that that's like so many writers, because the writer of that, or the writers of that, have done a lot of editing and seen a lot of people's manuscripts. And I think almost all new writers do that. I did that in the first novel that I wrote. It's like you're creating the story from scratch, obviously.
Yeah.
And you feel like you've got to go back and sort of have that conversation with yourself about the characters and about where they came from. But actually, it probably doesn't need to be in the book.
No, it's a bit of a safety net as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So no one can come along there and go, why was he like that? Why did that happen? Actually, if you read page 4, where I clearly outlined his childhood trauma with the blah, blah, blah. Do you mean that you've got to have the confidence just to...
Yeah, just dive into the story. And some of that you can refer back to later if you feel like it's important. But I mean, weirdly, I'm saying all this, but I actually don't mind all this sort of the history stuff.
No, I guess it's horses for courses.
And it's like the history of the, you know, the movement of Jewish people. And I mean, it's interesting as well.
And I think as well, there's that thing, if you called it a prologue and started later on.
Although that people tell you not to do
People
that.
Tell you not to do lots of things, but if it makes sense for your story, it makes sense for your story.
Also
there was
true.
Another Twitter thread the other day about swearing in books. Mm. Do you use swear words in
your
writing?
Depends on whether the characters will swear or not.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, what? And then people go, I won't read a book if it's got swearing in it.
Well, presumably they like a very specific kind
swearing.
Of
swearing. Yeah, no, there's only just a couple of swear words that they'll stand by, but the rest of them they don't like.
Two light swears per book.
But I'll tell you one thing I thought Craig did very well, and this is something we've seen in his writing previously, is without leaning on it, he gives a very good feel
of the time that we're in.
Yes.
But it doesn't yeah, do anything to do it. It just happens underneath the story.
He is very good at
less
that.
Less talented writers would over-explain some feature of a building or something. Do you mean that
yeah.
kind of...
Yeah, it's just the way in which it's written sounds a bit older.
Yeah, yeah, there's just...
For that particular bit.
It feels of that era, that kind of first yeah. half of the 20th yeah. century, doesn't it?
It does. No, he's a very good
So would you say it's worth Craig continuing with this, John? As is ours, obviously is our position to judge on these matters.
I'm really looking forward to reading more. I want to read more. I think once you get into the nitty-gritty of the story, I feel like it's going to be really yeah. interesting. I mean, it's a particularly interesting moment in time.
Yeah, yeah, you've got a lot of historical happenings that everyone's very aware of, very good shared cultural things yeah. that you can just use, can't you?
Yeah, and the characters, it's a really nice character. It's a lovely idea for a character, someone who almost can't help themselves, but, you know, tell these stories. And the fact that they all have this sort of slightly kind of biblical quality as well.
Yeah.
I think that's lovely. So, yeah, looking forward to reading the rest. But, yeah, my only tiny criticism is get to the story. Get to the story,
yeah,
Craig.
Jump into the action quicker and then feel free to come back out of it and go back to wherever you want
to. Yeah, yeah. Because you don't mind that, do you? Once you're into a story and you're into the characters and you want to know what happens next, you don't mind a bit of exposition. You don't mind a bit of meandering.
No, absolutely not. But yeah, it's asking a lot of a reader, isn't it, to go through that at the start before there's any buy-in to anything.
I think you've got to have the confidence just to go, here's my characters, are you interested in them? And you don't actually have to explain everything about them, and that's all right.
And I think probably the best compliment I can give it is that when I got down to page 22 where it ends, I kind of went, oh.
Yeah, same. I was looking forward to having a bit more. Keep sending us it, Craig. We could just keep reading. Yeah, three chapters
at a time.
Do
this every week.
It's probably, it's a good way to get Tom to read a book.
But thank you very much for sending it in, Craig. Yeah. I hope that was okay. A bit weird relying on us for feedback, to be honest. It's not going to do you any good whatsoever. But fortunately, there's been other people stupid enough to send us stuff in as well.
And also, Craig is almost certainly just going to ignore that advice because he knows who it came from.
You just sit and chuckle and go, I knew they'd say that, the idiots. That's why I sent it. Speaking of how not to write a novel, the book, that is a very good book, very entertaining, actually.
It is. It's excellent.
We should have a dig around and see if we can get one of the authors on the podcast.
Let's do that. That would be excellent.
Worth having a little read of that if anyone wants to get hold of it.
It's surprising how much you can learn from how not to do things, which seems to relate well to this podcast.
It's quite easy to dip in and out of it as well, and it's quite funny in places. Yeah, there are some really, really funny bits, and you kind of go, oh, God, I do that. You kind of laugh and then self-admonish.
Yeah, right.
But it takes the edge off because you're laughing.
It's a real cringy David Brent laugh. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. So there ends our as-yet-untitled Whip Me With Your Story feature.
We'll keep thinking.
We'll come up with a little song. What's next to discuss, John? Nothing, you say. That's the end of the podcast.
Exactly. That is it. Let's wrap it up.
Lovely.
But not before saying, do tune in next time, which will be in 2 weeks. We are chatting with Kasim Ali, who is one of those really annoying writers who just like burps, and he's got a book. We're going to have a little chat with him. Some interesting insights. Yeah, some insights we've not had before as well, which will be quite interesting to listen to.
Well, good.
It is good, Tom. It's very
lovely.
Good.
Bye for now. See you in a couple of weeks.
Tati bye.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?